Do you know these names? Archie Moore, Jose Torres, Sugar Ray Leonard? They were all world champion boxers. They all dominated their division, and they all thought they could punch above their weight. But when they went up a weight class to take on bigger opponents, they took a beating. Now, according to many foreign policy analysts and our political leaders, Australia punches above its weight in the world.
We are proud of our track record as a nation of punching above our weight. I think we've seen that through many generations of foreign policy. I would obviously want to continue that.
We sometimes underestimate our clout around the world. Yes, we are a middle power. Nevertheless, we are a significant, even a substantial middle power. And we should use our weight in the world for our own good, for the good of our friends and allies and neighbours, and for the promotion of the values which are so important if every human being is to live in peace and freedom in the months and years to come.
It's true, we are a medium-sized regional power with an increasingly muscular and activist foreign policy. For example, we were the first nation to back US airstrikes against Islamic State terrorists. When that Malaysian Airlines jet crashed in Ukraine, we were one of the most vocal nations against Russian aggression, and we were a prominent player in the US-led coalitions against the Taliban in Afghanistan and Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq. But there are sceptics, and I'm one of them, who say it's not just presumption, but possibly even dangerous for Australia to punch above its weight. After all, we have a large continent to defend in a turbulent, unstable region. It's a point well made, I think, by Owen Harries, one of Australia's most distinguished conservative commentators, in his 2003 Boyer Lectures.
Australia spends under 2% of its gross national product on defence. It has an army of only 25,000 men. In these circumstances, for it to engage in serious military campaigns beyond its region as well, and to do so preemptively and when it is not directly threatened, is to leave itself open to the charge of being a cheap hawk, which is a dangerous and irresponsible thing to be. Punching above one's weight may be a source of pride, but it is also hazardous and a form of activity best avoided.
So should Tony Abbott, a former champion boxer himself, avoid punching above his weight? Or does Australia have a responsibility to respond, where it can, to the world's problems? Let's dig a bit deeper. Greg Sheridan is foreign editor of The Australian newspaper. His books include The Partnership, the inside story of the US-Australian alliance under Bush and Howard. And James Curran is associate professor of history at the University of Sydney, and author of the soon-to-be-released Unholy Fury, Whitlam and Nixon at War. Greg Sheridan, is Australia punching above its weight, or is this just a meaningless cliché?
Tom, I think it's a completely meaningless cliché. I'm surprised the ABC researchers were able to dig up Julia Gillard using that ridiculous remark. It's not a common phrase in Australian foreign policy and hasn't been for 20 or 30 years. Australia's task is to punch to its weight. We are the 12th or 13th largest economy in the world. We're the 16th or 17th largest defence spender. We have one of the biggest land masses in the world, and we're one of the richest countries in the world. Now, if we don't make a contribution to the global commons of international security, we're not living up to the obligations which our size and wealth lay on us. I don't think there's any question of our punching above our weight. In Afghanistan, we punched way below our weight. In fact, I think Australian governments have been very cynical in making token commitments and getting massive alliance benefits out of them from the United States. Far from the US manipulating us into something we don't want to do, we've manipulated the US into all kinds of things that we want it to do at very little cost.
The Vietnam War. James Curran, does the term reflect a long-standing foreign policy tradition, or is this really just a meaningless cliché?
Well, I think it is a false barometer, really, by which to measure the success or otherwise of Australian foreign and defence policy. Nevertheless, despite the fact that prime ministers might not have used it explicitly for a long time, that idea of Australia getting a seat at the biggest diplomatic tables around the globe has been a fairly consistent one. I agree absolutely with Greg that on many occasions Australia is actively encouraged, for example, the United States, to continue the fight in places like Southeast Asia and particularly in Vietnam. The question is what sort of value and what sort of bang for our buck in terms of influence and access that we get out of it, but that's probably for later. I mean, if you were to look over Australian history since Federation, you can see quite a number of examples where Australian leaders have tried, if you like, to get their voices heard in the higher councils of world power. Now, they're doing this for completely justifiable reasons. They're doing it to advance Australia's distinctive interests. Hasn't always worked. Now, just because they've failed doesn't mean they've failed policies. But if, very briefly, you were to consider, for example, Alfred Deakin in 1909 trying to get the United States to extend its Munro Doctrine to cover Australia and the South Pacific. Billy Hughes, yes, he got Australian separate representation at the Paris Peace Conference, but he antagonised the Japanese, something which really wasn't a good thing in hindsight, given what we saw with Japanese militarism in the 1930s. John Curtin, in 1944, wanting to propose another Empire Council, he was about the fifth Australian Prime Minister to do it, and when he proposed it in London, Churchill didn't even turn up because Churchill was going to briefings on the D-Day landings. Percy Spender, wanting Australia to have a seat at the global planning processes of the Pentagon.
This was Menzies' External Affairs Minister.
Menzies' External Affairs Minister. The Americans did not want to have the complication of a junior ally at the policy planning table then. Menzies in the Suez Crisis. Billy McMahon trying to get a seat on Nixon's plane to China, would you believe? And the list goes on.
So the means aren't matching the ends. Greg Sheridan?
James is a fine scholar and knows a lot about Australian history, but I'd offer a completely contrary interpretation of Australian history to that. I would say Australia has been extremely well led strategically through almost all of its history. The very act of federation was a strategic act to secure our continent. Alfred Deakin used the very limited tools at his disposal to get Teddy Roosevelt to send the Great White Fleet to Australia against British opposition to secure Australian support for a naval fleet, and it did in fact secure a commitment by Teddy Roosevelt to Australian security. Billy Hughes was an effective representative of Australia at Versailles, and Japan didn't go to war because of Billy Hughes. Spender got the ANZUS Treaty when Menzies thought he couldn't get it, and that's been absolutely fundamental to Australia's position ever since. Spender got the Colombo Plan, which was originally called the Spender Plan. Keating got everything he wanted out of APEC, including all the strategic dividends. Howard got American participation after their initial reluctance supporting our East Timor venture. I think the ledger is massively in the positive. Australian prime ministers have used the limited tools at their disposal. They haven't got everything they want, neither has anybody else. That's the nature of human condition, but they've done pretty well.
You made it clear that Australia has been, is and will continue to play a substantial role on the world stage. But what's in it for Australia? I mean, we spend less than 2% of GDP on defence. This is the Owen Harries argument. We have an army of around 25,000. We have a large continent to defend in a pretty turbulent, unstable region. What's in it for Australia, Greg?
Well, first of all, we have a small army because we're a maritime power, but we have a very powerful navy. We have the most powerful navy in our region, and we're about to acquire 100 Joint Strike Fighters, which will give us the most powerful air force in our region. Our alliance commitments in the Middle East and the like have several dividends for Australia. First of all, we have an interest in the maintenance of global order. Now, you can argue whether, Iraq was a success or failure. I'd accept that argument. But in principle, we have a genuine interest in the mission itself. Mm-hmm. Second of all, by being with America, we do influence the conduct of their policy, as I made clear in my book, The Partnership. And third of all, we certainly incur reciprocal obligations from the Americans. Now, no one can suggest the Americans are negligent in their fundamental alliance obligations. And in the meantime, we get from the Americans massive intelligence, which we couldn't get anywhere else, of the operational kind, not just secrets, but things which mean that our planes and ships and so on are infinitely more effective within our own region than they otherwise would be. We also get massive logistical support from the Americans, and we get privileged access equal to or beyond anyone else to high-tech American defence equipment. Now, given that we've got a much smaller population than all of our neighbours, that is absolutely essential if we're to maintain our defence edge in the region.
James, let's talk about the US alliance, because as Greg suggests, it has been since the time of Menzies and Spender. It clearly still is, and it will be for the foreseeable future, the centrepiece of Australian foreign and defence policy. Doesn't our role on the world stage earn us the protection of the US alliance? I mean, isn't that very valuable to Australia?
Well, it certainly is. But look, the historian in me says, go back and look at some critical episodes in the history of the alliance where the treaty and Article 4 in the treaty has been really put to the test. Now, the two significant examples are in the 1960s in disagreements with the United States over Indonesia's desire to annex West New Guinea, and then subsequently Indonesia's policy of confrontation towards the new Malaysian Federation. In both cases, the Americans basically told the Australians that our interests were secondary to the broader Cold War policy of making sure that Indonesia did not fall into the communist camp. Now, this was very painful for Australian policymakers at this time. You had John F. Kennedy sending the Australian External Affairs Minister Garfield Barwick out of the Oval Office with his tail between his legs because he said, people in the United States have forgotten ANZUS, were Kennedy's exact words. And then in the later part of that decade, even after the fact that Australia had been one of the very few Western allies to support the United States in Vietnam, did that give us any increased access to US policymaking and influence? I would argue it didn't. They left us out of all the critical decisions about troop withdrawals. We got no advance warning of the Nixon Doctrine about a scaled-down US military presence in Southeast Asia. And when Nixon went to China, Australians learned about it from the newspapers.
All that said, though, Greg Sheridan, the American alliance surely counts when it really matters.
Well, of course it does. Every power broker in the whole world knows that. But even on those episodes James cites, the Americans probably did us a favour by stopping us escalating West New Guinea or Malaysia.
Absolutely.
The fact that you're an ally doesn't mean that you can get your big friend to go to war every time you feel disgruntled.
Yep.
But there is no doubt that an enormous part of Australia's influence, especially in Asia, comes from our unique relationship in Washington. I spend a great deal of time in Indonesia. I must have made at least 50 visits there, probably more. The number of times Indonesian officials at the most senior level, from the president down, have said to me, we couldn't have got this done in Washington without Australia's help. Indonesia doesn't have a diaspora community. It doesn't have a big business community backing it in Washington. It has one very big friend in Washington, and that's Australia. Now, that's not because we're geniuses or anything, but because we are allies of the Americans, we can get access to them at a very high level and say to them, we want you to do this on Indonesia because it's in our interests as your ally. That may not be decisive in all cases, but it is significant. And so in the Indonesian mind, when they're making a calculus of what is the size of Australian power, that influence with America is a factor. And that's all through Asia, with the Chinese, with everybody else.
Question for both of you. Does the protection of the alliance also come with a cost? I'm thinking of the criticism advanced by the likes of Alison Bronowski from ANU, the veteran diplomat Bruce Grant. Their argument is that by giving unqualified, unconditional support to Washington, we are, especially in the current era, that we are increasing the likelihood of Australia being a terrorist target. How would you respond?
Well, I think they're probably over-egging the pudding somewhat. There's no doubt we are in an age where there has been, on both sides of politics, more unqualified support for the alliance than in previous years. I mean, if you looked at the period from Whitlam right through to Keating, there were quite a number of areas where Australia took a different stance to the United States, where we were in conflict. And in fact, there were differences, you know, earlier than that as well. I think this idea of unending civility is a deeply flawed one. I think sometimes Australians can overestimate the costs. I wouldn't, because I've seen very close up when I worked in government the sorts of benefits the alliance can bring. I agree with Greg that in the current environment, where the central question of our time is the rise of China, that arguably we mean more to the United States than we did before. So I think some of these criticisms are drawing on very old and dated and dusty briefs that were really the sorts of assumptions that were brought through the Cold War period. This idea that Australia is always sacrificing its independence to a great and powerful friend, that it's never been able to prosecute its own distinctive national interests.
Greg Sheridan?
I don't buy it.
Yes, I completely agree with James about that. There's an antique quality to the likes of Bruce Grant and Alison Bronowski. Mm-hmm. I don't just mean that they're very aged. I respect people who are old, but but their documents. It's like a Victorian spinster smoking a cigarette or something. I mean, there's just a sort of a silly antique quality to these arguments. But two minor points I'd make. One is, we have never given uncritical, unqualified support to the alliance. We support the alliance, absolutely, but that doesn't mean we agree with American positions. We've got millions of things we disagree with the Americans about. We disagreed with them linking most favoured nation trade status to China with human rights. We disagreed with trade stuff against Japan. We disagreed with them on a million arms control treaties. I mean, I disagreed with the Australian government on this, but the Rudd and Gillard governments disagreed with the United States over Israel at the United Nations. It had no consequences for the alliance. We agree with the Americans 99% of the time because they're doing what we think is right. And does it make us a target for terrorism? Well, that is just absurd. You know, every European power, no matter how anti-American its politics have been, has been the subject of this terrorism. All the Arab nations are the subject of this terrorism. First of all, it's kind of creepy and pathetic to say you can appease the terrorists by spitting on your friends. And second of all, it's not effective anyway.
Well, let's look at the big issue at the moment. That is Iraq. Of course, Australia and the United States were strong supporters in bringing down Saddam Hussein's regime in 2003. Right now, we have all the available public polling evidence indicating strong public support and bipartisan support for the mission in Iraq to take out the Islamic State terrorists. Is there a danger that we are picking sides in what is essentially a morally ambiguous Sunni-Shia dispute? You've got the Islamic State terrorists, one of many Sunni jihadist groups, fighting a regime in Baghdad backed by Iran and supported by a lot of Shia militia groups. Why should Australia get involved in this dispute? Greg?
Well, Tom, I am influenced by your analysis on this matter, and I have a lot of sympathy for it. In essence, the Shia-Sunni dispute is none of our business. I do think Islamic State posed a particular threat to us and through attacking the governments such as they are in the Middle East. And now there is an enormous premium on functioning governments. But this intervention we're doing is infinitely more modest and limited than the intervention of 2003. I think it's a sort of a marginal thing whether our special forces should be there. But in trying to stiffen American resolve a little bit, I think on balance, it's reasonable. We have a very limited objective, which is to stop Islamic State. Other than that, we should try to empower local actors. And all we ask of local actors is that they don't commit genocide against their own people and that they don't attack us. We have no more ambitions than that.
James Curran?
Look, I agree with that. I mean, the real issue here, though, I guess, is do these kind of niche contributions that Australia makes, is that the model for alliance management in the future? Mm-hmm. I mean, I would very much like to know what the Americans really think about the nature of our contribution. I'm sure that they appreciate it, but I'm also sure there's pressure mounting for more. I mean, you could ask the question, if the threat is so mortal, why aren't we committing more ground troops? Why aren't we committing ground troops in the first place? And also, what's the end game here? What are the unintended consequences? I mean, this flows from your own analysis, Tom.
Yeah.
What real impact is this going to have?
Well, another critical aspect of this discussion is where, given, you know, our limited resources, all countries have limited resources, where we focus our international effort. Greg, if the purpose is to defeat terrorism, wouldn't it make more sense to focus our resources on our region? You've written a lot about this in your articles and books, that terrorism has been arising in Southeast Asia as well as the Middle East. And isn't that more likely to impinge on us?
Well, I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We are making a massive counter-terrorism effort in Southeast Asia, but thank God there is no call for our special forces or our Air Force to be active in Southeast Asia. There is no context in Southeast Asia in which we would want to be deploying the resources that we are currently deploying in Iraq. If it were a choice between deploying your F-18s and your special forces in Iraq or in Southeast Asia, it would be no choice. You'd go to Southeast Asia. But there's no one in Southeast Asia wants those resources. And I've been to the counter-terrorism school that Australian money built in Semarang in central Java. It's a magnificent facility. The Indonesians love it. It has students from all over Southeast Asia. It's a very big contributor to counter-terrorism. So I think we can do both.
James Curran, do we even have the means to meet the commitments we're making now?
Well, look, I think what we're talking about here is one of the great abiding themes of Australia's role in the world, and that is how the tension plays out between its cultural attachments to the great powers and its own geopolitical interests in this part of the world. You know, the tensions between history and geography. Absolutely, the number one focus should be on what are the processes of radicalisation that are taking place in Southeast Asia and how do we meet them. As Greg said, we're already taking great steps to do that. John Howard, among others, showed that it's possible to walk and chew gum at the same time. That moment in October 2003 when you had Bush and the Chinese president address the parliament on successive days. Obviously, that may become more tricky and more delicate as the years go by. But yes, I mean, budgetary concerns will already come into it. I mean, there's already great pressure on the government to expand its defence spending. That will only increase as the years go by and as the threats mount.
Greg Sheridan?
Yeah, well, I think that's right. The Abbott government has increased defence spending in the way that it promised it would. But like all Western nations, we've made promises to ourselves that we can't keep in the pension and social spending area, and we face a long-term budgetary crisis. So you have this secular question across all Western governments. Can they pay the money that is necessary for their own defence? And trying to defend this country without the American alliance would cost us, you know, eight times what we're paying now. So to some extent, we're getting it on the cheap. I don't think we're spending enough on our defence, but I don't think the deployment in Iraq is a significant
free rider.
Problem.
Is there a risk? Well, we look like a free rider?
We're a little bit of a free rider because we basically didn't do anything in Iraq and we didn't do much in Afghanistan.
Look, I had some direct experience of this on a visit to Washington some years ago, where some quite senior people in previous administrations said that they felt Australia was becoming a little bit too enjoying of having the chest puffed out on the White House South Lawn. And another one said there were too many Australian leaders going to Washington and having their egos stroked at Washington barbecues. And there have been several stories in the press over recent years about US commanders on the ground in Iraq being very frustrated at Australia's rules of engagement. So I wouldn't overplay them, but I think they are certainly there. There are some frustrations at the American end about how loud we roar on the alliance at times. But then, as I said before, to what extent can these niche contributions continue as a serious model for the alliance?
Well, we began with a quote from Owen Harries. Let me wrap up with a quote from Rich Armitage. He was a former Deputy Secretary of State. About a decade ago, he said, quote, "Australia punches above its weight. Australians don't accept that fact. Americans count on that fact." Greg Sheridan, James Curran, fascinating discussion. Thanks so much for sharing your insights with us.